Welcome to the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Centers podcast. In this recording, join Jillian Manis, Managing Partner at Structure Capital, for an exciting discussion on the future of digital health with Guillaume Deswerck, founder of Well, and Dr. Carlos Bustamante, founding director of the Stanford Center for Computational, Evolutionary, and Human Genomics. Here they are.
One of my guests tonight is Carlos Bustamante, and Carlos is at the forefront pretty much of everything in health, and I can't wait to introduce him tonight. But we had this conversation because I always think that now you have these huge companies coming into this investment, but investing time in order to create better insurance, lower cost insurance for their employees. But I'm going to take it one step further. I think corporate America at one point is going to be able to provide insurance to everyone, not just their employees. And I think they're going to want to do this because they're going to want the data. And so I'm looking at a world where maybe corporate America will be able to subsidize insurance completely. And I'd love to talk to both Guy and Carlos a bit about that tonight, but perhaps you also can think a little bit, and let me pop that over to you. Does that make sense? Now, I'm just going to pretty much end on this because I was mentioning at the beginning, but one of the things, and if you know what blockchain is basically it's taking data. It's the ability for people to take data in many different silos and place it up on a blockchain for others to be able to share the data with trust, because that data is secure within these little blocks. Think of it as a chain of blocks with data in every little block. And one of the reasons I love this is because there's so much inefficiency and so much distrust in healthcare, really in every single institution that we have right now. But in healthcare, we're holding our data so close, and we should be. We're worrying about how it's going to be used. And some of us want to monetize our data. But I think the next iteration and the next, I would say, revolution really is going to be in blockchain. I think this is going to provide the ability for all of us to share the data that these digital devices are now providing such insight into. So I'm popping this back over to all of you to really think of what in your life, how you would want your data to be used, and how you think data in general should be used, and how it should be controlled. And that's one of the questions that I'm going to start off with my two wonderful guests tonight. So I'd like to welcome up here Carlos Bustamante and Guillaume Deswerck. Hi there.
Hello again.
Hello, hello, hello. Okay. I have a list of questions for all of you today. And I think, as I said, what digital health is changing behavior, and we know that. But I think there's a worry. I think there's a true fear in everyone right now. We have too much. We don't have enough. What are your thoughts about that? And Carlos, first of all, maybe you should just introduce yourself and tell us how wonderful you are.
Oh, sure. What a privilege it is to be here with all of you. I'm Carlos Bustamante. I'm a professor at Stanford. I'm a professor of genetics and also biomedical data science, and I'm chair of our biomedical data science department. A lot of my research has focused on human genetic variation and its importance in global health, in particular in minority populations, and trying to understand how we can do a better job of bringing the benefits of technology into a global health setting. So, as I said, it's a privilege and a pleasure to be here, and I'm really looking forward to our discussions.
I am too. Carlos and I always have these fascinating, very high-level discussions, and then we go really, really granular, and then we lock heads. It's fantastic, and he always wins. So, Guy, can you tell us a little bit about you? You're coming out to healthcare a little bit differently, and I'm so happy that you're one of our portfolio companies. I'm pretty proud of what you're doing. And it seems to be your company, I always say, is sort of a post-it note that why didn't anybody do this sooner? So can you just introduce yourself a bit? And
absolutely. My name is Guillaume Deswerck. I'm one of the co-founders and CEO of a company called Well. We're based in Santa Barbara, California. My background is in the consumer technology space. So I spent a number of years at Google working on initiatives for search and Google Trends. And then I had the crazy, maybe naivete of going into healthcare. And it's been a fantastic 3 years. I'm excited to chat more about it.
Fantastic. Thank you. So, Carlos, how much information is helpful? How much is hurtful? Are we at the point that we can really make that call?
Yeah,
that's
a great question. I mean, the way to think about it, and we were talking earlier about evidence-based medicine and what we might call precision health. So when I took anthropology years ago, one of the things that I remember is that magic, science, and witchcraft basically explain the same set of phenomena, right? Things that you can't otherwise make sense of using our senses, right? Our five senses. And in medicine, I would argue it's been practiced like witchcraft for a long time, right? You give people this or that, and it's whatever happens to work from Hippocrates on. And the idea behind evidence-based medicine is that we should take a scientific approach to medicine, right? Let's base our recommendations on rigorous science and the best approaches. In the notion of precision health, the idea is to take the individual's data. Mm-hmm. Let's boil it down to the data, because in reality, it's a set of diagnostics that one would run, but ultimately it's data, and try to use that to differentiate how to treat the patient based on those pieces of information. So should I give them chemotherapy A or chemotherapy B? And as we've collected more and more data, you realize there are absolutely cases where if you give them chemotherapy A, you kill them. And if you give them chemotherapy B, you kill the cancer, right?
Right.
So how do you use this going forward in a prospective way? Ultimately, it's about the individual having trust to share that information. And it's also about taking what I would say a healthcare versus sick care view. A lot of our healthcare system today, I would argue, is devoted to reactive medicine, to treating people once they've already presented with disease. How do we really think about the long ball? How do we think about keeping people healthier? How do we think about millennials and my kids who are Gen Z, about keeping them healthy? Because ultimately, that is the way to avert a lot of the healthcare costs that we're going to have that are ultimately some of the biggest challenges we face as a society.
You know, you hit upon, this is a really important point. I listen to a TED Talk every day. I have for 3 years. I believe that you should evolve every day. I don't necessarily watch it, but I listen to it, so it can be anywhere. And I listened to this fascinating TED Talk on incentivizing physicians to, in a way, rather than curing, it is totally around preventative. So it's incentivizing physicians to keep their patients healthy and paying them for a healthy patient rather than a sick patient.
Right.
And I think that's just flipping healthcare on its head. But how exactly would you do that? And then that leads you to having enough data in order to provide you with that precision medicine, that precision health, so it's not these inefficiencies of tests or these sort of wild diagnoses, which, as you know, 30% are actually not correct as it is, are false. And so I think you've hit upon something that this digital health is really the driver, which is the precision medicine, the precision health, as Stanford is one of the leaders in it, and you are very much on the forefront of. But can we then take a society and incentivize the good health of the society? And I think the trust piece is a critical lever, and the digital, the collection of the data. But once again, and I'll pop this over to you, Guy, is there too much data, do you think, that we might be then sort of, we should be fearful of, or is it not enough, or where is data, can data be used in a positive way and a negative at the same time, or a positive way without the negative?
And we were speaking to this a little bit earlier, and I have a unique perspective that's probably shared by a lot of people here as a millennial. And my perspective is take all of my data, do whatever you want with it, as long as it doesn't come back to bite me with insurance down the line where I can't be covered for pre-existing conditions. So I'm take it all, just provide me value down the line.
Just curiosity, here in the audience, how many people feel that just take my data, it's going to help me, it's going to help society, take my data? See, this is really interesting.
This is a very San Francisco thing.
Yeah, I know. You know,
if we had this... Actually, in Boston, of all places. I gave a talk at the Broad Institute. God love them. I love the Broad. Work with them all the time. I gave a talk out in Boston a couple weeks ago exactly on this idea that disruption in consumer health was really going to upend our tertiary and quaternary care centers.
Absolutely.
And it was like crickets in the room.
Right? Really?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very different mentality. It's a view that, for lack of a better word, you know, that it should be the paternalism of medicine, that the doctor knows best, that
yep.
we've got to be able to have a federal system that's going to solve healthcare for everybody. And I just don't believe that that's going to happen, right? I just don't see that in the cards. I really believe that we are living through a massive transition in how we're going to pay for healthcare going forward. We have no choice but to incentivize people to stay healthy. And we want to live in a society where people are incentivized in that direction. And if that is the case, you actually create sufficient value to take care of people who are sick, right? If you think about healthcare costs, there's a great billboard down on the 101 for those of you who drive down that way that says, everybody's in the healthcare business.
Yes. Right?
No matter what business you're in, everybody's in the healthcare business. Because if you're an employer, you are providing healthcare to your employees.
Yes.
If you're in the gig economy, you're paying for healthcare yourself.
Yes.
Right? And you're paying $10,000. We're all paying societally $10,000 for man, woman, and child. And half of us use less than $1,000 a year of healthcare spend.
That's a really interesting statistic. Say that again.
So we're paying on average $10,000 for man, woman, and child, right? The total size of the healthcare industry, it's about 20% of GDP, a couple of trillion dollars.
Right.
Okay. Yet half of us use less than $1,000 of healthcare a year, right? It's less than 2 to 3% of the total spend, right? It's a very, very, very fat-tailed distribution where the top 1% of claimants use up about 20% of the pie. And 5%, just 5% of claimants eat up 50% of the pie.
Yes.
Right? It's just crazy. And in homage to Pareto, there's a 20-80 rule. It's that 20% eat up 80% of the pie.
Yes.
Okay? So how do we think about introducing incentives for preventative care? Because, I mean, the docs are in the room saying, Carlos, everybody knows preventative medicine is far better, right? It's a question of how do you incentivize it? How do you create the system?
Right.
Right? And I think the key is, from millennials and Gen Z on down, right? We've got to take care of them and keep them healthy, full stop.
Right.
Right. And then figure out how we percolate that on up to my generation, Gen X, and, you know, baby boomers on up. Because the baby boomers as a group have already been eating and eating and eating and eating, and they're going to get more expensive. So we've got to come up with a solution ASAP or we're going to be in trouble.
Right. And efficiency is the key. It's the data that is the key. But then on one hand, we have all these devices that are collecting this data for us, and it's informing us, whether it be 23andMe, which I didn't find that much information, but that's okay. I knew but we'll leave that aside. But it's all the way down from the watches to the bras to everything that we're doing. But then where is the physician in all of this as well? And where is the breakdown between, I know every time I get sick, I Google myself, you know, and then I get
so
even
your
sicker.
Doctor.
Well, okay. This is a really good point. So Guy, here comes Well. And one of the biggest disconnects and the most frustrating parts is, yes, we can sit there trying to, you know, self-diagnose, which I do all the time. And much to my chagrin, I'm always dying. But then I try to get in touch with my doctor. And either I can't get in touch with her, or I'll be on the phone for 30 minutes. And then it makes me more frustrated. And then I have this tremendous lack of information and this frustration, and it sends me into another stratosphere. So you are working directly on this, and what you always say is it's the trust, but it's also the communication piece that is tremendously broken.
Well, I think we need to fix the relationship between patient and health system first.
Yeah, regardless of how much data.
Well, we already have so many ways to capture data, right? What we're lacking is true insight. So 23andMe is a great example. I did 23andMe.
Yes.
I learned new things about myself, but I had no idea how to apply it.
Yes.
I don't know how this, if this resonates with anybody else in the room. My Apple Watch, it tells me how many steps I did. Fantastic. But, you know, I had a nurse once call me skinny fat, which means you look healthy because you're skinny, but you're actually not healthy. My watch to tell me that and tell me what to do. And I actually have another example. I'd like to gain some weight, right? And I want to make my wife happy. She, you know, get rid of the skinny fat. And
give you some Snickers bars.
Yeah. So I would love, going back to the data piece, take all my information. I'll post it on Google. Anybody can find it. Just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Tell me what to do. Tell me what to eat. Tell me when to eat it. Tell me when to work out. Tell me how much to work out.
But
nothing
does
that for me today.
Correct.
A personal assistant
right.
plus a nutritionist.
And Alexa, who I seem to ask everything right now. And she could probably tell you everything a little bit. But there's the right
time. Don't you
want to
live in that world? Don't you want to live in a world where Alexa gets used to also help monitor you post-operatively, right? So Alexa has your knee. It's doing a little bit better. Great, right? Because we spend a ton of money on follow-up, and we don't have the precise way of doing it.
The problem today, though, is that the relationship is non-existent. You go to the point of care. You're seen for 5 minutes. You leave. You're forgotten. And the relationship, and this is our philosophy on the space, the relationship starts with your very first phone call. Mm-hmm. In fact, in my opinion...
You can even get it through.
Yeah, that's true. But by that measure, by that standard, and because 80% of your interactions are going to be with the support staff, as far as the relationship goes, those are the folks that we should be focused on.
Mm.
And they're non-clinical. They're the ones that are on the other end of the phone that are helping you navigate your care. And today, the problem is that we're staffing, you know, for the average health system, probably Stanford, a few hundred call center workers that have a bunch of landline phones and are navigating 30 pieces of technology that all talk to the patient independently. So as the patient, you're completely lost, you're frustrated, you're confused, and you're at your most vulnerable. This is what makes me figuratively sick, right? Of every industry that exists today, healthcare should have the preeminent customer experience, but it's the worst.
Yeah.
Healthcare is the third worst, actually. Guess what two industries are worse than healthcare in terms of customer service?
Government?
DMV and cable companies.
Well, there you go.
DMV for sure.
That's the government.
Even with net neutrality?
Yeah.
So I'll make a comment on the support side because I think you both mentioned 23andMe. I happen to be a huge fan of 23andMe. I think what 23andMe is doing, which isn't necessarily evident, is that they're helping us crowdsource information about the human genome that eventually will help the development of new pharmaceuticals. So it is doing a very useful societal valuable thing. It's just not necessarily transparent to the user.
Right.
I would say that in the context of genetic testing, one of the most important roles in the entire system is actually that of genetic counseling. And the operative word here is on counseling. It's not the genetic part. It's the counseling piece.
Yes.
And in fact, you know, for those of you who are looking for, you know, the next generation of jobs, genetic counseling is one that we cannot fill fast enough, right? Huh? We've got a great program at Stanford, and we just, our students go out and get jobs immediately, right? Because it's one of the most useful aspects of the healthcare system today, precisely because it helps navigate all matter of decisions about what medicines you should take, how you should be thinking about potential surgeries. So it's a way of saying that I think we are creating those jobs, and it's happening from some of the areas of medicine, from pathology, from genetics that are sort of closest to the digital side. And it's a question of how do you push that out?
But just what you said, that goes to the transparency side, because how many of you have used 23andMe? Once again, if we were in Boston.
they won't let you in Boston.
Yeah,
in New York. In New York, you actually can't do it.
What?
Right. No. In New York, you need to have your doctor's permission.
You have to go up to Canada and buy the test.
Yeah, you got to go to Canada. You got to go to New Jersey, right?
I am gobstopped.
I'm serious.
I had no idea.
Yeah. They couldn't do the spit parties in New York.
Yeah, I love a good spit party. That's shocking, but that just goes to show. So when I did 23andMe, I learned a wee bit of information that I really didn't feel was that valuable, to tell you the truth. But had someone said, listen, your data is so important. You know, your data is actually helping us create these data sets and it's doing this and that. I think a lot of people would just opt into 23andMe for the humanitarian part and that it's going to help all of us, not just me.
But then the question is, how do you make that insight effective?
Yes.
And I think part of the issue right now is that we have so many players in the space solving different problems and they're having to manage that communication pathway independently, and it's impossible to have a relationship without continuity in that conversation.
Sure.
So when 23andMe tells you, hey, you're at risk of Alzheimer's, here's some of the things we'd recommend, that's going to have a very different effect than if my doctor, who I've been talking to for the last 4 years, have scheduled my care with, have received feedback from, delivers that insight to me.
Yeah.
And I think as we think about the space, unifying that communications and enabling that fluid relationship Absolutely. Is going to be core to unlocking value.
Well, the other part is, you know, if we think about, for example, a medication plan, let's take, for example, hypercholesterolemia that impacts about 1 in 300 people. These are folks that from the day they're born have high cholesterol and can't necessarily tell. Someone in this room may suffer from FH. And you don't find out until you have a heart attack in your 40s or you have a stroke.
Right.
Right. Most people are not diagnosed. 90% of these folks are not diagnosed until their 30s or 40s, when it's often too late. They already have cardiovascular disease.
Right.
If we could intervene earlier, if we could intervene either at birth or when they're adolescents,
right.
and you put folks on a statin regimen or PCSK9 inhibitors, you literally avoid 80 to 90% of the heart attacks and strokes that these folks are going to have. And a big part of that's actually the medication management part, because yeah. it's not just saying, oh, you've got FH.
Right.
Here's what you should do, because the doc could prescribe you the statins. If you're not taking them, they're not necessarily doing what you need them to do. But if you're able to get the patient on the right regimen, if you're able to incentivize them through the right relationship, boy, that has tremendous value. You might even be able to sell that information up a value chain where you might reinsure those people. We could maybe cover all FH patients if we got them onto a system where they're properly adjudicated and put on the right regimen, because that information is such tremendous value, it could be the source of new therapies. That's how we found PCSK9 inhibitors in the first place. So there's a virtuous cycle between data sharing, between getting patients and doctors onto the right precision medicine and precision health regimens that we all benefit from societally, that we are going to be discovering over the next decade. I mean, in my mind, I think it's one of the most exciting things that's happening today in technology.
So do you think that's why Amazon and Google and all those are really stakeholders in this? Is that, you know, is it just to sort of line their pockets and increase their right and their value?
So I find the Amazon, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and what are they focused on? Because as you're describing this, I kind of see three components of this
sure.
virtuous cycle,
yeah.
which is the data yeah. and where there's a lot of hardware and a bunch of applications that are collecting data. There's the insight. 23andMe is doing
sure.
some stuff here. A bunch of other companies are. And there's a counseling piece, we'll use the counseling word, where you actually make the insight actionable and
sure.
feed it back to the end consumer to make, you know, fundamental changes in behavior.
So I have no secret information about what brought Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon together, right? But I can just imagine the three of these guys, very, very brilliant guys, pulling their hair out saying, oh my gosh, right? I run a self-insured entity. I'm literally paying when my employees have a heart attack. This is crazy, right? That's what self-insured entities do, right? You know, when we think about health insurance, a misnomer. Health insurance today isn't insurance in the way car insurance
no.
is insurance in case something happens.
No.
Rather, it's a way of meeting your federal obligation to provide health care for your employees.
Yeah.
So they said, look, guys, let's come together. We got 1 million people between us, and we can, you know, Silicon Valley this in some regards, right? Or
right.
West Coast this.
Right.
We can come up with a better solution that makes use of technology and that we can learn from and potentially democratize. It also is, of course, not escaped their attention that healthcare is 20% of the U.S. economy. So if you're Google, you're Apple, you're Amazon, and you're looking for new markets, what are you going to go after? Healthcare. It's obvious, and it's only going to grow, right? We're at 20% today.
Right.
Where do you think it's going to be as millennials get older, as Gen Z gets older? We could literally be living in a society 20, 30 years from now where 30%, 40% of the GDP is devoted to sick care, right? So, of course, they see that, and it's an opportunity to intervene. There's great incentives on both the employer side, and there's incentives for them to bring new products and services to market that could actually bring delight to healthcare. Who talks about bringing delight to healthcare?
Do you think I'm nuts that potentially there would be a time when corporate America would come step in and say, listen, we're doing this for 1 million of our employees, right? And corporate America would say, this is much better value for us to prevent this from having, by informing, to prevent all the sickness, the debilitation of America. It would be better for us to have a healthier society that would buy more, that would use more, that would communicate more. Do you think that's a possibility, or you think that's
I think it's an inevitability.
See, I do
what's the number one heart monitor today? Anyone know? Your Apple Watch, absolutely right. You get an A+.
Yes.
So the ability, this is a project that my brilliant colleague, Ewan Ashley, started at Stanford working with Apple Watch. We had this great student who was working on trying to predict atrial defibrillation from the LEDs on the watch.
Yeah.
And it worked. It absolutely worked, right? So this is classic Clay Christensen disruptive technology, right? Things that look like a toy until they, you know, take out the top of the market. And today, if we think about healthcare delivery, if we think about the devices, it's going to come from consumer electronics, and it's going to come tied to CVS. It's going to come. Why does CVS and Aetna want a merger?
Yes.
Why does Walgreens start thinking about having minute clinics in the back of every shop?
They are.
Because they get it.
They get
absolutely get it.
But they're collecting the data.
Absolutely.
This whole thing is a data play. When you go to the CVS, it's all about the data. So let me ask a question. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask a follow-up question. Who becomes a counselor?
That's where you guys are in a great business.
That's right. So, you know, you get
the
data.
I didn't mean it that way, but
You want Uber docs and Uber nurses, right? Yep. To what degree can we push care? As I like to say when people are at Stanford, and I point to our hospital, our beautiful new hospital, I say, the most expensive place to get healthcare in this country is in that building right
now. Absolutely. We have a company, one of Structure's companies called WorkPath. It's mobilizing labor workforces and healthcare. So it's because, and if I talk to the people at Stanford, which I have there, they say anything to get people out of the hospital.
Absolutely.
It costs us so much.
Absolutely.
If we can have some way that we can send the pick line nurses, that we can send phlebotomists, that we can send people and mobilize, this makes perfect sense. And, but also it's collecting the data because it's the data in the home, it's the data in the hospital, and there are definitely variables.
In fact, you know, you and I are both Anglophiles.
It's completely.
And, my son was born under the national healthcare system in Britain.
Right.
And I will tell you that the prenatal care and the postnatal care was super good. The actual natal care was horrendous, and we could talk about it at some point, right? I mean, it's just like you would never want to do it. But the postnatal care was incredible. We had a nurse that came to the house the day after my son was born, weighed him on an old butcher scale. Not a problem. I don't care about the accuracy of the scale was irrelevant. The scale was an excuse for the nurse to come to the house and say, is mom okay? Is baby okay? Right? So why can they deploy that at that ultra low cost? Because they've got these set of, of community nurses that can interact. We can absolutely disrupt in that way,
absolutely.
Right? The same way Uber and Lyft and all these technologies are creating that economy. We can push this out in ways that absolutely make sense. That's what I'm excited about. I mean, corporate America has to solve this problem because we know government hasn't solved it today.
And
so why are we going to keep waiting?
The other fundamental piece here is the data information exchange, because healthcare is pretty fragmented. You go seek healthcare at different health systems, perhaps from different employers. And now you've got this world where your data lives in a bunch of different silos and it doesn't really talk
blockchain.
Well.
Okay, we'll get to that. Stay tuned for the next series. We'll be on blockchain.
But that's the other big issue that I see that without fixing that.
Agreed.
You're 100% right. So
I was
on a panel with a brilliant, brilliant guy who is the head of purchasing for United. And we were talking about genetic testing in cancer. He's the head of purchasing for oncology. And as many of you know, today there are now literally tens of thousands of genetic tests that a doctor could order to tailor your cancer therapy. Okay. And he said, Carlos, I don't know how to reimburse a cancer panel test. Because by the time it gets to me for reimbursement, I don't know what genes were on the panel. I don't know why this test was chosen versus that test. And I don't know why I'm paying $1,000, $10,000, or $30,000, right? So I, as much as I get it that we need this information to tailor therapy, I can't pay for it. I can't, you know, it doesn't make sense for me from the business side. And then he said, but I'll think about buying it and buying that information when it's low enough.
Okay.
When it costs $500 to sequence a genome, I'll buy it tomorrow.
But now we're there.
And invest in the patient.
But okay, so now we're there.
Absolutely.
We're there. To sequence a genome, at one point it was $4,000. Everybody thought that was a steal. Then it was $1,000. Now it's less than $1,000. Is that correct? To sequence
first,
your genome, about $200 if you want to sequence your genome. Now, on one hand, you've got, I've actually done this now, all right? And it is you know, I didn't even want to open up the report, by the way, which is like 800 pages. You know, you don't want to open it up because I'm, in a way, that's the reason I don't go to fortune tellers. I don't want to know what is going to happen to me. And yet I do want to know what's going to happen to me, but I don't want to know. And so it's a tug, it's a pull push. But on, but it was inexpensive enough to have it, and it would also be able to inform my kids. Now comes the physician piece. Now I have to be able, because I can't possibly analyze all this properly. And even though my genome has been sequenced, it's very difficult. So now I'm dealing back again with the physician. And that seems to be the missing piece in all of this. Is there some way that you've created this communication, this ability to communicate well? Can it lay over an existing communication platform, Guy, or is it something that we're going to have to start building on top of and building out? I mean, how are you going to scale and how are you going to meet the demands of so much data and so many questions coming at us?
So from our vantage, from our perspective, yes. Our thesis is that there's the platform itself, the UI, the tools that the users engage with. But then you have to build a very friendly developer ecosystem where people can pipe that information. It'll be communications to start so that it is a single threaded view and you understand the context of a patient and their experience with your health system and potentially other health systems, other technologies, other services over time.
Right.
As you were saying that, and Carlos was finishing up his sentence, it made me think about the power of the insurer or the self-insured employer in this scenario. Because the same way that your colleague or your acquaintance said that he would pay for the data. It's funny, we had conversations with employers and they said, hey, we'd love to actually pay for your services and give it to health systems because we want to minimize.
So there's 80%, as I understand it, 80% of employees would be willing to have genetics or other part of these technologies as part of their wellness programs, as long as the employer wouldn't use it against them, which is very logical.
Yes,
so the question is, will they do it?
Will they?
Absolutely.
They have a unique opportunity.
Absolutely.
So people are having their genome sequenced. You don't think that what the information that the employer is not going to say, well, gee, in 5 years or, you know, that.
Well, so today there's a firewall. There's a big firewall between what the employer has access to and what you get as part of your wellness.
So it's all about the control back.
Absolutely. And you know, the value proposition has already been proven. You look, again, we talk about England. Cameron government spun up a wonderfully interesting experiment called Genome England that spent £200 million. They allocated £200 million to do genome sequencing at the same time they did standard of care. Right. And they were going to do 100,000 genomes. They cut the pilot early. After the first 30 or 40,000 genomes, because it was just so economical. It was just like, oh my God, it's a no-brainer. Let's just put this into the insurance cost of the NHS. And whenever it is clinically indicated to do more than a single gene test or a couple panel tests, we'll just order the genome because that information is so valuable.
Right.
Right? So you're in a situation where you're talking about the difference between price and cost. The cost of genome sequencing today is epsilon compared to the analysis and the utilization of that information in the context of care. So if we invert the model and you put it in the hands of consumers and employers to subsidize, it's a no-brainer.
Except it's not that easy. I mean, I'm going to pull it back to the fact that we're sitting here in the Entrepreneurial Center and there are some founders in the audience and there are some people, they're investors, and you're all trying to, and some of you, and you through the camera, are wondering, okay, there's a lot going on. Clearly, there's a tremendous amount of momentum. There's a tremendous amount of investment. How do I get some of this investment? Mm-hmm. How difficult was it for you? What were the biggest challenges on this? You know, I know you're raising your Series A right now. You've also moved your company from Silicon Valley to Santa Barbara. Oh, my. And for many of us here in the Silicon Valley, especially in the venture community, we really feel that it's important for companies to be here so that we can parachute into them periodically to have really the hands-on approach, which really early stage companies need. We involve ourselves in everything from the hiring to strategic growth plans to the funding to all the bits and pieces. So you did a very gutsy move. You took your Silicon Valley company, which I invested in because it was in the Silicon Valley. That was one of the parts of it. And then you went, goodbye, Jillian. We're going to Santa Barbara. And I thought, well, I want to go to Santa Barbara, but not so much. I'm still here. So, and you're doing well. And so talk a little bit about, especially in the healthcare space, which has very long sales cycles. And it's definitely, we love the fact that Amazon and Google and Apple or everybody is hands in, but that's at a very high level. They are looking at startups. They are investing in startups. I know that for a fact. But Guy, you're dealing with it from the entrepreneur's lens, and perhaps you can provide some insight on some of the challenges and some of the rewards of building a company in this space.
So I think the kiss of death in raising money is, first and foremost, if you're in healthcare, it makes it much harder. And then two, if you're not
Wait, hold on the point. Who here is a founder or an entrepreneur and is building a company in healthcare? Oy vey. Okay. So the good news and the bad news, you're going to give some good news too, right, on this.
Yeah, well, investors are really scared of the sales cycles, right? So they're terrified of how long it takes to go to market and the capital in some cases if you're doing hardware. And then, so the second kiss of death, and then I'll give you the good news. The second kiss of death is not being in the Bay Area. Investors don't like it. So we stayed in California. So your flight's not too far.
Thank you very much.
So structurally, I think I was just naive. And I built a business the way I wanted to build a business and the way I thought would make me happy and have the maximum impact for value. And I listened to a lot of great counsel from folks like Jillian, and I listened to a lot of it, and some of it I ignored. And what I was thinking to myself was, I'm going to be doing this for a long time. We'll probably take this company public.
You can't say probably.
We will take this company public, yes. And where do I want to spend the next 15 to 20 years? How do I give myself the best chances of being successful and ultimately providing value to the world? And for us, that meant escaping the two-hour each-way commute, getting everybody showing up to the office at the same time. It meant a lot of the things that San Francisco couldn't afford us. It meant escaping the tremendous competition and crazy salaries that you can't afford when you're a bootstrap company. And that's what brought us to Santa Barbara. The other aspect to it for us, to speak to Santa Barbara briefly, is that I personally am very customer obsessed. And this came from my time at Google. I believe in dog fooding. I believe in measuring everything. And in a large city like San Francisco, it's hard to dog food because you have a bunch of major health systems. You're unlikely to sell any of them because they have 100 companies trying to sell them and get the logos on their page.
Right.
But you can do that in a market like Santa Barbara with health systems that don't have as much noise and command the marketplace. So I'm in a position where my employees can use our software every single day. And their friends and their family use it every day because they all get healthcare from the same facility. So,
and you said that you found talent there as well, because we all worry that there's not enough talent. And you said there's actually a lot of talent that's incoming that's saying, gee, you're a Santa Barbara company. You know, I'm here stuck here in the Silicon Valley. Can I come work for you? And I think that's a very interesting way to sort of change the dynamics of
how
we
perceive. Recruiting has been a net positive for us.
Yeah,
there's less talent. But in fact, most of our talent has come from LA or San Francisco. It's just a bit harder when you have established families with roots built in. It's harder
to
move them. But we get tremendous inbound candidates. And with a university local, it's us and five other companies vying for the talent. I mean, there are many others. I'm oversimplifying, but it's a big difference from the 10,000 in San Francisco. We interviewed so many great individuals when we were based in Redwood City. And I can't tell you how many times they're getting offers three times as big as ours.
Can I tell you? I actually think so.
And you have consulting. I mean, you have a consulting company. And so you deal
and
with these all the time. And you have built companies. Do you have the same sort of mindset?
Well, I actually think so. In the United States, there isn't one healthcare system. There are at least 50 different healthcare systems.
Yes.
Because most of the cost in Medicaid and Medicare is borne by state and federal government. Mm-hmm. One of the most exciting places today to do healthcare startups is actually in Tennessee out of Nashville.
Yes.
Vanderbilt is absolutely crushing it. Okay.
Yes.
Vanderbilt had a beautiful paper earlier this year where they had invested in doing genetics on their cohorts going forward. And they were able to show, beautiful paper in Science, that they have 20 to 30% underdiagnosed Mendelian disease in their healthcare system. And if that's Vandy, that is the same, you know, happening in every healthcare system. We just don't even know it yet, right? They've got innovative companies that are doing insurance in Vanderbilt or in Nashville because it's the heart of the insurance business. There are wonderful companies in Minnesota, for example, that are doing genetic counseling online. Yeah. So lots and lots of super exciting things are happening. And so I think, you know, the future of this whole space is going to be distributed. You know, it's going to be smart investment. And the thing to remember is that pharma, tech, they cannot innovate internally. Right.
Yes.
They have to acquire that talent.
Yes.
And so you look at what are the big pharma plays that are happening over the last year. they were all diagnostic businesses that got bought
yes.
at 150, 200% premium, right? Why? Because every pharmaceutical company has a drug development cost of $2 to $3
billion, right.
right? And so they need to figure out, how do I target that drug to the right subpopulation? I need the diagnostics. Diagnostics in general is a terrible business to go into, but because it's a data business with a wet lab attached.
Right.
So if you can get the data and prove the value, boom, that's
yes.
your flat iron. Those are the plays that
yes.
are getting bought up. And they're not just going to be out here. They're not just going to be in New York,
right.
and they're not just going to be in Boston. So I think there's a ton of exciting things happening. I don't even think they're going to be in the United States. I think there's tons of work to be done in Latin America, in Asia, in other parts of the world where innovation and frugal innovation are actually going to disrupt from the bottom of the market.
I can't agree
right?
more. And
Frank,
I think
we talk about diabetes
keep...
monitoring, right? Why? When we
yeah.
talk about diabetes monitoring a dollar or two per day, we're like, well, how do I bring this diabetes monitor to Africa? What about the fourth world in this country?
Yes.
Right? What about the poor people in this country
yes.
that can't manage their diabetes either? Those public global health solutions need to be brought into our inner cities, into our rural poor, into a lot of this country that is completely underserved, but it's also the gold from which we're going to learn to manage disease.
But that's the health disparities. We talk a lot about that in terms of digital health and the applications.
Yeah.
I mean, that really does address. We need, one of the buzzwords we always hear is global data sets. We always talk about, you can't just get the data sets here in the U.S. and you can't just get that 1% or that 5% at the top or the 50%. You really have to have that, the complete, what I would say, comprehensive data, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be just as broad across the globe. It has to go deep.
Absolutely.
And the disparities around healthcare is something that we have to address. This is a way to address it. I don't know the clear path to
but
this.
But it's a huge opportunity, right? Why wouldn't you want to own the data stream on how you're able to manage the 450 million people in the world that have diabetes?
Yeah.
Give me a break.
Yeah.
Right? Talk about some of the most exciting things that are happening. Google figured out, look, diabetic eye problems are one of the biggest problems out there. There are not enough ophthalmologists out there, right? So how do I invert that problem, create a machine vision way of diagnosing the diabetic problems that people have that are in their eyes, like the eye is the heart to the soul, right? You know,
right.
the window to the soul.
Well, we're talking about the smart contact lens.
Absolutely.
You know, we're talking about
the smart contact lens. But this is just even just photos, right?
No, right, on your phone.
You know what's interesting with the data, though, something we've come across, and I know a lot of technology entrepreneurs in healthcare come across, is data aggregation and healthcare mm-hmm. contracts. And selling into health systems, they often don't want to give you access to that aggregated data, which is a problem. Now, if you sell into Google, Facebook, they've got much wider reach. It makes sense. Apple, I shouldn't have said Facebook, Amazon. So that's something we fight
that's
for.
That's going to change.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
going to change. And I'll tell you why. Because today, most of healthcare economics focuses on the data the hospital has. Right? That's like what every hospital in the country is doing, right? What clinical informatics. So Stanford Hospital wants to break down their data silos. Let me bridge my electronic health record, my imaging, my pathology, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
UCSF's trying to do the same thing. Everybody's trying to do the same thing. Why? Because they rely on insurance to pay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? But I would argue that 95% of the data that I want to manage patients' health in 2025 hasn't been generated yet and will come with the patient into the examination room.
Yes.
So the patient will have that information with them, should own that information. And if we create the right incentives, can actually sell that information and be compensated.
So when I build a $20,000 medical device and I can't sell that to the patient and I want to get it reimbursed by insurance, but I'm selling into the health system, how do I navigate as a vendor, as a healthcare company, that world? And wanting those data aggregation rights.
Don't make a $20,000 medical device.
Yeah.
Make a device that works off your iPhone.
Because it makes sense with the Apple. It makes sense with the Apple Watch.
100%.
But as you get more and more clinical,
100%. How much did a Zymo patch cost at the beginning, right? How much did all of these monitoring devices cost?
Well, the higher the demand, the lower the cost.
There you
go. I mean, that's it. So, Guy, on your platform, are you able? How do you use sort of the customer data for measurement for you in order to build this product out? And how much of that can actually also be provided to inform your partners, your enterprise partners? Because I think that how your platform works is also part of the whole data revolution as well, right? Any type of data, whether we get it off a watch or telephone or texts, That's all going to inform and build out this much better communication.
So today it's mostly communication. It's conversational. It's NLP on top of conversation history, and it's more administrative in nature. So we're really focused on establishing the channel, enabling the conversation flow, and that conversation naturally expands beyond the administrative use cases.
Okay.
I think long term, the reason we fight for data aggregation is that there's tremendous opportunity to make everybody better. And that's how we sell it to our customers. We say, look, you've got 3 million patient encounters a year. We've got another 50 million. Mm-hmm. And you want that 50 million. You want that data. You want to be able to say the readmission before they come back.
Absolutely.
Now, we're not there yet, but that's why we fight for it, because we know what that's the future looks like.
And I should say, look, we've been beating up on docs this whole afternoon. Of course, almost every physician I know got into the business because they want to take care of patients.
Yes.
It's both the humanity side and the science side. They're as frustrated as we are. I come from a long line of doctors. My dad's a physician. My grandfather was a physician. These are people who devote their whole lives to taking care of their patients, and they would love nothing more than to keep people as healthy as they can. The problem is we only produce 15,000 doctors a year in this country. Right? And so there's a huge opportunity to empower them with the very best tools and technologies so they can do a much better job of taking care of
them. They also don't get paid to keep you healthy today. They get paid. There's a transition, but there's an economic disconnect.
No, absolutely.
And I think that will transition. I mean, I think we can create the incentive for that to happen, because at the end of the day, and this goes back to your point about corporate America.
Yep.
Corporate America, since day one, has always been the biggest employers of physicians in this country. So at the turn of the 19th century, the biggest employer of physicians, anyone want to take a guess? Railroad companies, absolutely. A plus. That's where Kaiser Permanente came from and others, right? Through up until the Great Depression, in the fee for service, it was the docs getting paid, you know, directly from patients and the employers, right? We invented insurance and obfuscated a lot of how payment goes, but at the end of the day, we made a federal obligation.
Absolutely.
So it's been corporate America and the American taxpayer who's been paying.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, they harbor the risk today. How do we create the right incentives to make long-term shifts in the risk structure so that you incentivize 20 to 30 year timelines? Because pharma can work on those timelines.
Yes.
Right? Pharma can say, look, I can bend the cost curve. So that system is coming and has to come, or we're toast.
Oh, and we're seeing a lot of success. We have customers in the Medicare Advantage world, and you've got primary care docs in the Midwest making more than seven figures, and it's not on a fee-for-service model. It's literally just managing a panel of patients.
There you go.
I think what we're all looking at in terms of healthcare is that we need to reverse engineer this world, right? We need to know, and that's really where we're heading. We need to know where we want to be in 50 years, where our children, where we want our children to be, where we want our grandchildren to be, and then back into it.
Absolutely.
We're always here in this, a little bit of a microcosm here in the Silicon Valley, but also just in general in healthcare. We want it. We're plowing forward. We're keeping the momentum forward. But I think in a lot of ways, we have to go to the future and then back up
Absolutely.
Into it. And I guess the one question, this burning question is, on one hand, I know what now scares you, maybe. What scares you? If you were to say one thing that scares you the most and one thing that you feel most optimistic, what would that be? And I also, from the entrepreneurs, because we've all three of us had built companies, what is that one nugget that you would throw out there for all the people who are either thinking of investing or building a company in this space? Is there a sort of one sort of lesson learned that you can live from?
Sure.
So, scare, happy, nugget.
Absolutely. So I love it. I call this the Black Mirror question. Who watches Black Mirror, right? So what's the Black Mirror scenario here? The Black Mirror scenario is that only rich people can afford healthcare. That is already today the case. And that you could create a system where fewer and fewer people have access to high-end care.
Yeah.
And that things are just going to get worse and worse and worse. And so the rich will have not only better health and more money and more opportunity, and nobody wants to live in that world. I think that's just a huge problem. I think that we can absolutely create a scenario of rising tide lifts all boats. We're beginning to see it with consumer electronics, and I think the incentives are coming. Corporate America gets it, and I think the gig economy is actually going to help, not hurt, in this scenario. So I'm super bullish in that regard. What I'm most excited about, I think, is that we live at a time when so much of what we need to do to stay healthy is at our fingertips,
right?
If we create the right structure. People want this. They want better food. They want better health for themselves and for their kids. And we can get there, right?
Yes.
You know, it's not witchcraft anymore. There's a ton of science out there
yes.
that we can bring to bear on the problem, and it's just going to get better, right? The compounding value of the data streams we all generate is just higher and higher into the future. So I'm optimistic that data science with the right human focus, right, and user experience and the right incentives is going to solve this. Best advice to entrepreneurs, you know, look to your left, look to your right. Entrepreneurs are just everyday people like you and me, okay? You just have an idea and you got a burning desire in your heart. And so God bless you and keep at it. And it's all about the team, right? So surround yourself with good advisors. Be smart about the money you take in. Be smart about the people that you bring into your team. It's like everything else, right? Who do you invite to your house? Who do you invite to come live with you, right?
Right.
Starting a company is like a marriage, right? You got to be all in and you got to make sure you got the right partner. And, you know, keep trying, keep trying. You know, you learn something from every company you build, even if the exit's not what you want or it didn't go the right way.
You learn from your failures.
100%.
I mean, you learn from your failures. The first thing I always ask an entrepreneur, one of the first things we ask, how'd you fail? How'd you fail? I want to see people who failed. And guess what? We've all failed, bottom line. If you haven't failed in business, you failed in personal, in your personal life. That is such a very big value for me, for an investor, for a person. It also makes me feel that you're self-aware. And self-aware founders, Guy, name one thing, one golden nugget you would just like everyone to know about your experience as a founder and you wish someone would have told you. And now you're going to tell thousands of people inside and outside the room.
I'll boil it down to two things.
Okay.
The first is, you know, in a time when mental health is so prominent in the entrepreneurship world.
Everywhere.
Well, that's true. It's okay. You know, we pour our blood, sweat, and tears, and we'd rather, you know, the last thing we want is for a company to fail, but it's just a company, right? At the end of the day, your investors would rather you try a second thing if the first thing doesn't work out. So it's just a company. You can move on, and it's not the end of the world. So that's the first,
because right.
I've seen a lot of that,
oh,
and it's very, very lonely. And the second piece, and I think this is just something that's just natural to me, is it just takes a lot of grit. I think the number one quality in an entrepreneur is grit. And the second is listening. And if you work hard enough and you have enough confidence and you keep at it and you listen to the right people, you can't screw up.
Okay. I'm going to give one piece of advice to everyone. One of the things that we look for in terms of in the venture community, especially at our fund, but we're trying for everyone to buy in. We really need for all of us to invest in values, not just valuations.
100%.
And so when you're building your companies and when you're building your teams, it is as important that you have the respect component, the empathy component, patience, open communication. That's how we're going to build the systemic change for our country. It's with the startups. You have to instill values in everything that you do. And I don't want to get preachy. I'm just saying it right off the top. It is really about how you are building your life and your companies around your values. That's really what's going to create change. And if, in fact, we want a healthcare system, we want a healthcare system for everyone, it's because we care about everyone. And it has to start right with you, your companies. Your strategy has to be about values. And that truly is, for me, that's comprehensive healthcare.
If you do good, you'll do well.
You do well, you do good.
Thank you
so much. Awesome. Thank you, Gabe. Thank you, everyone.